And I'll try this out too. All right, so this is apologetics, scientific apologetics session 8, believe it or not. And we are at page 23 of 36 on the 7th outline. And if you recall, we're talking about intelligent design up at the very top, at the header, at premise 3. Intelligent design is inferred as the most plausible explanation of scientific observations. So what are the other explanations of scientific observations that we've been kind of using to figure out what makes sense of this data? What are the titles of the other explanations? Naturalism would be more of the worldview. That's more of the worldview stuff. But there were three based on that explanatory filter that we talked about 2 weeks ago when we first started intelligent design.
Well,
chance, that's one of them. And then the other was?
Physical necessity.
That's right. A-plus student right there.
I'm just looking at my notes.
Oh, okay. All right. And then the last one is obviously somebody. Yeah, okay. So we'll just say design. We don't know if God's intelligent or not yet, or the aliens, or the gods in the trees. Okay, so obviously we have these three options. And what we're trying to do again is not argue from analogy, not saying that this watch that we find on the beach seems to imply that there's an intelligent designer, because look at it, it's a watch and it's super complicated. How else could it have been put together? We're not doing that analogy argument. We're drawing an inference to the best explanation. So we're trying to decide if any of these three options, remember that we generate a bunch of hypotheses with this abductive reasoning approach. We generate a bunch of hypotheses that best explains this body of evidence E. And E is a bunch of E1, E2, E3, remember? We have all this evidence that we're trying to make sense of. And so what best explains that big chunk of evidence out of these three options? Well, last time we talked about chance. We talked about the probabilities. Do you remember that? 2 weeks ago we talked about this universal probability bound. Do you remember that? It was 10 to the 150th power. And we said that anything beyond that universal probability bound, if you remember that spectrum I drew, anything beyond that, essentially, could be said to be completely unattributable to chance. So it's impossible that chance alone would have caused it. And we developed this number, or this number could be calculated, because of the fact that there's 10 to the 80th particles in the universe, in the entire universe. That's how many atoms you could possibly have when you add everything up. And all of the time that we have since the Big Bang, assuming the standard Big Bang model of science, and then that's how we were able to calculate this number with those two parameters. Okay, so basically anything beyond that could be said to be not attributed to chance. And then basically when we looked last week at the construction or the operations of the cell based on DNA and how proteins were formed, we were able to say, based on calculations, that the chance of one DNA molecule or one... How is this even... Nothing. One protein forming that is functional in the cell was 10 to the 164th power, if you look at your notes. Now that would be, over here, sorry, 10 to the 164th power. And so that is beyond the universal probability bound, and so we were able to say last week that chance is ruled out as an option. And what I want to do is I don't want to spend any more time on that. I just want to move into our next one, which we'll talk about this week and then kind of basically make some statements about design. And that'll be the class for tonight. The next week, and I'll talk about this idea of irreducible complexity too, which I have about 7 or 8 pages of notes on. But I don't know if I want to, I'm not going to give them to you tonight. I'm just going to kind of give you a sense of what irreducible complexity is. So we have about only 13 pages to go tonight, and then we'll finish up the conversation on the cell. And then next week we'll start talking about criticisms of evolution. And I'll talk a bit to you about what do I mean by evolution before we even get into it. What is evolution? And why am I criticizing it? And we'll get into that next week. So, but I'll just say this in advance, that evolution as a theory, as a whole, makes sense in certain respects, and there's obviously amazing and indisputable evidence for microevolution. So we won't be trying to refute microevolution, just so everybody knows, so you don't like go research this to death in the next week and study like crazy just to prove me wrong or something. We will be trying to criticize macroevolution in general. We'll be trying to criticize some other features of evolution, like random variations in the genome and things like that. So that's kind of where we're going in the next two classes. And then after that, we're going to look at physics and astrophysics, and then we'll get into, finally, at the end of the class, how to make sense of all this stuff, relating it to the Bible, and what sort of biblically-based Christian views are harmonious with this scientific evidence that we're talking about. Okay, so that's kind of the idea. Now, with chance, I just want to say a couple things on that. Last week, we finished up, but there's a couple really interesting quotes that I thought would be helpful to read. They're not in your notes, but you can just kind of listen. And a lot of these are not, are pretty much all of these I'm going to read, are not from ID theorists or people who hold to ID. Okay, this book is by a British mathematician, John Lennox, and he is a really brilliant guy. He's debated Dawkins and a few other people. And he speaks about, I don't know, six languages or something. When you look at him, you don't think of such a profound scholar, but he is quite brilliant. And the book title is God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God? It's a very good book, and it has a lot of chapters on the cell. So one of the things I wanted to read has to do with this chance hypothesis. And basically I said last week that chance is pretty much ruled out as an option because no biologist holds to this as an option. They all think that this is an absurd thing to hold to when you're talking about biogenesis or the origin of life, biogenesis. So just to go along that train of thought, Paul Davies, he says, making a protein simply by injecting energy is rather like exploding a stick of dynamite under a pile of bricks and expecting it to form a house. You may liberate enough energy to raise the bricks, but without coupling the energy to the bricks in a controlled and ordered way, there is little hope of producing anything other than chaotic mess. Other than a chaotic mess. So that's Paul Davies, again, not a Christian, a secular scientist. So basically he's saying that if you got a prebiotic soup, let's say that such a prebiotic soup exists, and you inject a bunch of energy, do you remember we were talking about those experiments done in the 1950s by Stanley Miller and those bulbs of gases? Do you remember that? So Paul Davies is saying if you inject a bunch of energy into this thing, let's say that's energy, it's like exploding a bunch of bricks and thinking you're going to get a house when they all come down. Okay? That's kind of the idea of saying something is going to form a cell based on injecting energy into a prebiotic soup. Okay, so that just to give you a sense of the people here who are chiming in on this discussion that are not Christian or not ID theorists. Blind Chance, this is another molecular biologist and an organic chemist, A.J. Carnes Smith. He says, blind chance is very limited. He can produce exceedingly easily the equivalent of letters and small words. So meaning you may get some amino acids forming, essentially. but he becomes very quickly incompetent as the amount of organization increases. Very soon, indeed, long waiting periods and massive material resources become irrelevant. So no matter how many resources you have and no matter how much time you have, they just become irrelevant because he, Chance, just doesn't have the type of power to produce that. That's what he's trying to say. And I will just read you a couple more because I just want to get you... Hey, Dan. Do you go by Dan or Daniel?
Daniel.
All right. Cool. Okay. I will just read you... I'll read you his, John Lennox's statement about these two other guys without reading their quotes. James Shapiro, a biochemist at the University of Chicago, also admits that there are no detailed Darwinian accounts for the evolution of any fundamental biochemical or cellular system, only a variety of wishful speculations. Even the highly critical review of Behe, Michael Behe, who formulated the idea of irreducible complexity, which we'll talk about later, even the highly critical review of Behe by Cavalier Smith, another microbiologist, concedes Behe's point that no detailed biochemical models exist, meaning that there's no models for the chance formation of complex molecules. Now, there are others that I could read. He basically does a really good job of kind of surveying a lot of the material out there, books and or journal articles, and it kind of gives you a summary of some of these guys. So, any questions on the chance hypothesis before we move into that? I just want to give you a sense of, I made a couple statements last time saying that most biologists don't hold to the chance hypothesis, they reject it, and I'm standing on that. I think all of them reject it because it's just absurd. And I'm trying to give you a couple quotes to back that up. But any questions on chance before I move on? All right. I got my coffee tonight at a very expensive coffee place. So, all right, I ordered a large. So, okay, page 23. Now, physical necessity right there on the middle of your page is then the second option when we consider, this is the same outline again as last week. Do you have it, Rachel? Okay. Maybe we could get that passed over. If you don't have the outline, Chris, our beautiful Vanna White assistant, will help you. Yeah, 7 actually, that's it. She's got it. Now, the idea of physical necessity, self-organizational hypothesis is what we're talking about. Now, this idea was first proposed in the 1960s and early 1970s. This is the approach of necessity or law. So this is the idea of an external force, or maybe an internal force, is driving the formation, if you will, of the first cell, or first protein. So it's something that has nothing to do with chance. It has to do with physical necessity, kind of like gravity. It's just, it happens, and it has to be that way based on the relationship of certain bodies. Now, this theory gained traction in the late 1970s by Dean Kenyon, who first termed it biochemical predestination. Now, consider again the alleged prebiotic soup of the early Earth. So this is the idea that there's this green, let's call it green, a bunch of chemicals, and they're just floating around in the ocean on the Earth, and they're just hanging out, kind of moving around like Jell-O, and lightning strikes them, and allegedly they would produce something. Now, he called this biochemical predestination. Is it possible that proteins arose directly from the prebiotic soup due to the inherent properties in the biomolecules? Is it possible that these things came together on their own, essentially? Did they self-organize all of these things? Did these self-organize? okay, based on their inherent properties. Now, perhaps biomolecules can be likened to something like a crystal where the force of attraction between the constituent parts would determine the order of the chemical constituents of the molecule to molecule to form a self-orderly crystal lattice. So perhaps it could be said that all of these things have these inherent properties, these internal properties, that would attract themselves to the other, and they could see these triangular ones can attract themselves to those, and these little ones can attract themselves to those, and then say the big ones attract themselves to those triangle ones, something like that, okay? Just to give you a picture. And if enough of these things have these inherent attractions, then perhaps they can kind of merge together on their own. And when that happens, they would kind of organize and form some sort of shape, if you will, like a crystal lattice. In other words, you think of like icicles, you know, on a cold winter day from a cave, something like that. The shape is predetermined by the inherent properties of the water and the surrounding atmosphere. It was first thought that amino acids had bonding affinities, which could explain the rise of functional proteins, as they are based on an adequate sequence of the bonded amino acids. So, for instance, if you have all of these things in this prebiotic soup, then and they start self-organizing, then eventually you're going to get these amino acids forming a linked chain, and that would eventually form that protein. Remember that weird thing I drew? It was like that. That's kind of what proteins look like, in almost a literal sense. And so eventually you get from these self-attracting properties, amino acids, that's the idea here, chain, and then you get the protein. Now, we talked about how this protein forms last time by DNA and the nucleotide sequence, if you recall. And again, this is the prebiotic soup. It's chicken soup tonight, actually. And just kidding, there were no chickens before the egg. I'm just being ridiculous. So they call it prebiotic soup. Now, let's assume that this actually existed, okay, because we're not so sure about that, but let's just assume that there was such a prebiotic soup. Now, so that's kind of the idea. Could the protein be explained by the self-attracting properties of the matter in the prebiotic soup? And if so, then you can explain a lot of what is happening in the cell, because the cell consists of lots and lots of proteins. And when you have lots and lots of proteins, you start to get certain functions of the cell, and the cell starts to work. Now, you have to have other things in the cell than proteins, but you need a lot of proteins. Okay, page 24. They thought that this would explain the sequence specificity of the proteins. Now, remember when we talked about sequence specificity, we were talking about specified complexity. Do you remember that from 2 weeks ago, kind of introducing this whole idea? Now, these are in a sequence, so let's call it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and let's suppose that instead of 4 there, all of a sudden we get like a 5,762 number. Oh, that's out of order, right? So they're saying that the order, the sequence of these, could be explained by bonding affinities of the matter that produces that sequence specificity. Okay, now if it could, this would explain the first proteins and the origin of the information. So if all this stuff happened in the prebiotic soup and it developed this sequence specific amino acid chain, then you get a protein, and it explains the first protein. Now, this was known as biochemical predestination. Again, it's the structure of the protein is predetermined by biochemical attraction between the constituent parts, which are these, the constituent parts, the little chemicals in the prebiotic soup. Okay, that is, the biochemical necessity of self-organizing amino acids was thought to explain the information of DNA. So this biochemical predestination or these bonding affinities was thought to explain it in the sense that explained it away. It explained DNA as information away. In other words, you didn't need DNA to get the proteins. Okay? Now, in 1994, keep that date in mind, this criticism of the developing ID movement, which was just starting to kind of blossom around the early 90s, was put forward by, and again, the stuff I just talked about was not part of the ID movement. It was just stuff that was developing in secular science, just science. But this criticism of the developing ID movement was put forward by Eugenie Scott, and she was and still is the executive director of the National Center for Science Education. And she references a leading scientist, Stuart Kaufman, in this little quote here I'm about to read. Now, just read this with me and try to understand. But this was a big criticism at the time in 1994. It's about 19 years ago. The study of how life originated is an active area in science today. The primal soup theory, the formation of replicating molecules on crystalline clay substrates, and the seeding of amino acids and other components of life from comets and meteors in which these molecules form spontaneously in space, and other ideas are under consideration. Meyer's contention, Meyer is Stephen Meyer, he wrote Signature in the Cell, he's an idea theorist, and 19 years ago he wasn't well known at all. Meyer's contention that life is too complex to form naturally ignores research exploring the possibility that life is actually self-organizing. Combining the tools of mathematics, physical properties of matter, which we just talked about, information theory, which usually is done by mathematicians and philosophers, this field has its roots in the work of Nobel laureate Manfred Eigen and has been expanded by Peter Schuster, Bernd Olaf Cooper's, and in the U.S. by several investigators, including Stuart Kaufman, whose newest book, The Origins of Order, Self-Organization and Selection and Evolution, was just published last year in 1993. These investigators observe that the building blocks of life, which are amino acids and other compounds known to form spontaneously, can link together, which we just described, and some of the compounds formed are autocatalytic, mean they can do this all themselves. They cause other amino acids to link up. Something like a primitive metabolism emerges in these models, and scientists are testing these models in laboratories. Exciting developments in the production of something very close to RNA, a major chemical of life, have recently been announced. If life is capable of self-organization, these criticisms raised by Meyer against primal soup biochemistry are irrelevant. So the idea here is that if all of this can take place, then the Meyer's criticisms of self-organizational theories are irrelevant because you can get the proteins without the DNA in the prebiotic soup, if you will. Now, this was in 1984, and she just referenced a big book that came out by Stuart Kaufman. Stuart Kaufman's book, The Origins of Order, Self-Organization and Selection and Evolution, proposed a self-organizing process that was thought to bypass the need to generate genetic information. So this guy Kaufman wrote a big book. It was thought to give a good theory on how to basically get the complexity in the cell. And in his book, he basically describes something like this: a group of low specificity catalytic peptides and RNA molecules could be enough to build a metabolic system. Some proteins known as proteases and trypsin are able to make peptide bonds at a single amino acid site. So again, these autocatalytic processes were taking place to build something that has a metabolic system, something that can nourish itself, essentially. Now, other scientists that you probably never heard of, neither have I since until I started researching this. A scientist named Ghadari, G-H-A-D-I-R-I. He has produced other experiments, kind of like Kaufman's, and he's cited all over the internet for stuff like this. And then guys like Robert Shapiro and Stuart Kaufman are some of the bigger names when you're talking about origin of life scientists, if you want to research this further. Recently, a leading scientist at NYU, Robert Shapiro, has recommended, take off the second, recommended metabolism first models be the subject of ongoing research, meaning that metabolism first models would say that just try to research stuff, guys, that has to do with metabolism so we can understand just the basics and see if we can produce proteins or cells doing basic experiments. And then you can get to bigger and better molecules later. Now, that would be a good place to start, he was suggesting, and he's a very famous Robert Shapiro biochemist himself, so he's kind of a leader in the field. So Shapiro, Kaufman, Ghadari, these are some of the bigger names that research the stuff. So when internet skeptics, I'll call them, want to like reference certain journal articles that have to do with the latest and greatest research, latest, but I don't know about greatest, they reference the stuff and say, see, this is what we got. You know, this is how we can show that you Christian ID theorists are all wrong. Well, these guys are kind of the premier dudes in this whole thing, and what they say has a lot of weight because they've been doing this for years. And so that's who I'm trying to reference here. I'm going to go ahead and say that there's a lot of controversy about this process, about these theories. And Kaufman, Shapiro, and other guys will basically say that we don't know. There's a lot of controversy. And in the last 19 years since that little article by Eugenie Scott came out, there hasn't been a lot of conclusive research on this in itself. So just because there's research being done, it doesn't mean it's the final say, nor does it mean it's the standard model, for instance, like the Big Bang model for the universe, the formation of the universe. So a lot of times on the internet, you're going to get critics referencing some journal, some scientific journal, could be in this country or say China or Australia or something, that shows some researcher doing some stuff in the lab and generating proteins from that. Yes, sir. Absolutely. This is, if you look up here on this board, you have three options. And somebody brought up the point, I think Steve, last week, that, well, suppose someone could talk about, I think, Darwinism or something. I'm not sure what your question was exactly, but maybe that's a third option where you combine these two, chance and physical necessity, kind of like Darwin does in terms of evolution. But what that idea presupposes, which we already discussed at the end of the last class, was that when you combine these things and you say that stuff can form over time as it replicates, well, you're assuming something at the very beginning. You're presupposing the idea that something is replicating. And then there's this idea of self-replicating proteins, that as these proteins replicate themselves or some other molecule is a self-replicator, then you're going to have a chance for the Darwinian mechanism to act on that self-replicating molecule, and then over time you'll start to get bigger and better molecules. But that idea, again, presupposes that it replicates, and it presupposes that there's enough information to build bigger and better molecules.
And so the idea is that not much information is needed, certainly not anything along the level of DNA, but somehow there's a minimal affinity, if you will.
Yeah, like for instance, you can get bigger and you can get some better molecules, bigger and better molecules, when you do this, let's call it the fourth option, okay, where you combined these two, physical necessity and chance, and we'll just say C plus PN. And then you're going to get, you know, eventually something like, we'll call it big molecule, you know, something more advanced or complex. But to get from this, to get to the cell, that is astronomically, is an astronomical jump. So in other words, you're going to get people researching all this stuff all over the universities all over the world, ongoingly, and they're going to continue to do this. And but you're never, you don't really get anything like this. This is like a car, and this is like a cup holder, if you will.
Yeah, but the hypothesis is to get to that, isn't it?
Yeah. That's the idea, is that they're trying to find a natural process that can take you from a bunch of chemicals through just natural processes alone and get life. And that this is about how far they've gotten. But again, it's all theory, and there's some experimentation to back it up. But a lot of this stuff is inconclusive, and leading scientists disagree that it's kind of the answer. And this has been going on. Again, I referenced that book that was supposed to be, this new research that was supposed to show all this good stuff. And then I referenced the 1970s biochemical predestination was a big textbook that was used at master's level classes in the 80s. That there were these bonding affinities here. And what we'll find is that later didn't work out, but I'll talk about that in a second. But you just don't get here at all, ever, from a bunch of these big stuff. This is like unbelievably complicated compared to this. And remember, this was like 10 to the 40,000 when we thought about chance producing it. And this was 10 to the 164th. So, you know, this is somewhere in between in terms of can chance produce this. And not even the cell, but just enough proteins for a cell. Just 250 minimal functional proteins for that. That's 10 to the 40,000 power. So if you remember that video I showed that had all of the operations of the cell, do you remember that? All these things moving around, a bunch of globs of bits and all this weird stuff. I mean, that was just nuts. How are these things moving like that? And then there's a bunch of things that didn't even show, just for clarity. But this is just beyond belief in terms of can physical necessity bonding affinities produce a cell? It doesn't really make sense. The reason why is because the cell has DNA. The cell has DNA. It has information. It has sequence specificity that has nothing to do with the proteins. And that's what we're going to talk about here. It has nothing to do with the proteins. This is the fun part. So now, the whole point of this is even if we grant a prebiotic soup existed, which we're going to say later that there's controversy about this. There's much of scientific research that has denied the existence of that. Then we're going to say that a bunch of these leading scientists that I reference, who again aren't IT theorists, they disagree that could even cause that because of the bonding affinities. So there's problems with this. And then let's say this does occur because, say, you do have that. Let's just say, just to give them all of that, okay? And let's say you can even get the big molecule. Let's just say all that. You can't get this because of the DNA, because of information. And that's what we're going to talk about. So let's grant, for the sake of argument, that you get all the way to here, just for the sake of argument. Okay? Now, again, there's problems all the way through with all this stuff. This whole idea of self-replicating proteins, there's problems with that. And again, I have quotes that I could read you in this book from those leading scientists that will dispute, or basically refute, the idea of this generating, the proteins generating by bonding affinities. Okay, so let's Okay, so now we're at the response. Any questions so far? Other questions? This is good. Thank you. Any other questions? No, not necessarily. A big bang, standard Big Bang model would not assume that. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay, so no, actually it's not, but that's a good point. You could suggest that maybe a fifth option could be that information came through cosmic sources, like a meteor, like she indicates. That could be definitely another option, say five. What I'm trying to do is probably stick to the predominant views. Design, obviously, is the underdog in the academic scientific community. This one is rejected, but this one is kind of where it's all at right now. That is a possibility for sure. Yeah, that's an option. Yeah. I'm not talking about it, I guess, but someone could propose that, I suppose, yeah. The information. So that's kind of where it's all at. So that's a good question. Randall, the information is such a big thing, and that is interesting that you said that, because design is this whole idea of an obvious answer for information, and we can kind of intuitively already think that, but the information is the key, and that's what your question points out. Could the origin? So we're on number four. Now we're responding to this hypothesis that we just described. Could the origin of life be explained by self-organization due to deterministic chemical or physical forces and processes? Okay. So deterministic meaning just the chemicals and the physics themselves kind of pushing things around. Now regarding Dean Kenyon, now he's the one that came up with the biochemical predestination book, and that was used in a bunch of secular universities in the 80s at master's level biochemical classes. In the early 80s, Dean Kenyon's view became widely popular. However, he began to doubt it. Dean Kenyon wound up refuting his own theory of biochemical predestination. They found that there were slight differences in amino acids bonding affinities, but that none of them coincided with the order of the actual amino acids found in known cells. So if you recall, this whole idea here is that amino acids, I don't know if you could see, but you know, they're kind of linked together here, and they have a sequence, these numbers, but then you have this random number there, like as if it's out of order. And so the idea is that when they researched the bonding affinities that amino acids actually do have, they're very weak bonding affinities, or attractions, if you will, weak attractions to each other. And some of them didn't have attractions at all, but some of them did. And the ones that attracted themselves together formed something like this. In other words, it was out of order. In fact, it was much more different. It was like 208, 772, some number, you know. And things were just out of order. But what we find in DNA is that things are in order. They're the way they're supposed to be. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You know, so what they found is that the amino acids, although they did have bonding affinities, they didn't match what we find in the actual cell. So the bonding affinities of the amino acids themselves don't suggest that they form them. Formed together. They had a self-attracting kind of process to form this link, this chain. So they started doubting this stuff. And they said, this is not actually what's in the cell, even though there are some bonding affinities. So that is, these amino acid bonding affinities do not explain the specific sequences of the amino acids actually found. Some still argue an experiment to show that the first protein did organize from the amino acid bonding affinities. Okay, so there's continued research, like we talked about. But even if the first protein could have formed this way, it is clear that the evidence for the formation of known proteins is based on the DNA code. So remember in the video and the other night, we talked about how the RNA comes and reads, transcribes, if you will, the DNA double helix molecule. Remember, it kind of unraveled it, it unwrapped it, and the RNA kind of comes and reads it, and then it goes and creates the sequence in another chamber in the cell. And so even if proteins could have formed this way in some experiment somewhere, even if you could produce a protein this way, in the actual cell, we don't find proteins being produced this way. We find them going through this mechanistic process, this machine, where the DNA is unraveled, the RNA reads it, it goes into the chamber, and it aligns these amino acids that are floating around. That's actually how the protein's formed. So even if you have this kind of self-attracting stuff happening, and you get that, it doesn't matter, because that's not what's happening in the cell. Okay, since known proteins are produced from DNA code, one must still explain the origin of the DNA information for sequencing amino acids. So here the issue again arises. Where did the information come from that does produce the sequencing of the amino acids actually in the cell? Where does that DNA sequenced, the sequenced nucleotides come from? We call it information. Later, it was observed that the flow of information is from stable DNA, from the stable DNA double helix template to the proteins and not the other way around. Some have proposed that the proteins give DNA their sequence. In other words, you get this because of the bonding affinities of the amino acids, then you get the protein, and then the protein actually determines the sequencing of the nucleotides in the DNA. That's what kind of their thought processes was. But now we know that actually it definitely is from the DNA to the protein. Information flows from DNA to the protein and not from protein to the DNA. And so each triplet of DNA bases specifies information to the RNA codons for exactly one amino acid during transcription and translation. Proteins cannot be unwound to give sequences like DNA can. So this is another interesting point. Once you start unwinding this protein, do you remember that whole idea of it going to form, and that form basically determines the function of the DNA? Function follows form. If you start unwinding the protein in some other shape to go, say, get information off of the amino acids sequence, then you're going to change the function of the protein. It's going to cease to do what it is doing in the cell. So you can't unwind proteins because they are damaged and they don't work. They're kind of fragile. And so that's another problem with this view of biochemical predestination. If proteins are unwound, they either react with other items in the cell, are destroyed, or lose their function without the ability to regain it as their shape is lost. Thus, it doesn't make sense to say that proteins store their own information. It doesn't make sense to say that the amino acids, based on their bonding affinities, are the information of the cell, and DNA just flows from that. It's the other way around. DNA is the information, and that's what makes the amino acids, and that's what we see when we go look at the cell. So they abandoned their self-organizational approach. Okay, and this is Dean Kenyon in the 80s. They abandoned that. And Kenyon now holds to intelligent design, believe it or not, view, as this view is the best explanation of the rise of information in the cell. So Kenyon now is an ID theorist. Eugenie Scott, if you go back to that quote, she referenced this guy Kaufman's work in 1994. So fast forward in the 90s. He transfers or presupposes the explanation to self-reproducing metabolic cycles. Other scientists have made similar criticisms. Kaufman realized that there was a deficiency and proposed newer research, but this still fails. Overall, he displaces the problem of accounting the origin of information by introducing new unexplained phenomena. Okay. Anybody get that?
Yeah.
So Kaufman in the 94 produced that awesome book that was widely, you know, there was a lot of excitement about it. And basically, he failed to account for the origin of information, to sum it all up. There was a deficiency in his research, and then later on he proposed other books and he proposed other research because he realized that first 94 book doesn't work. It doesn't correctly explain it. And so the reason why is because it displaces the explanation to something else. So he did something where he said, okay, well, there's this other entity essentially that was to explain this, but what the problem is, what explains that? That's the problem. And we already know that the DNA creates the protein. So his explanation doesn't work. And then he started proposing other stuff later on after that because he knew it. And so Meyer, if we go back to Meyer, in the last, say, 15 years, he claims that these models are bad abstract analogies that don't really match the actual cell. Robert Shapiro, again, secular, non-Christian, non-idea theorist, has acknowledged that so far we have not yet demonstrated the operation of complete metabolic cycle or its ability to sustain itself and undergo further evolution. So he's admitting that there's a little bit of a failure there. Now, Kaufman himself, okay, again, non-idea theorist, non-Christian, he says, Kaufman himself, widely recognized as a leader in biochemistry, he says that anyone who tells you that he or she knows life, knows how life started on the earth some 3.45 billion years ago, is a fool or a knave. Nobody knows. Okay, so it's pretty blunt, sorry, but that's not meant, that's just, I'm just reading it for the purpose of showing that leading scientists, non-ID theorists, recognize that there's huge problems with this view. Number two. Let me read one more. Let's see, again, the idea is where did the information come from? That's the information. The discovery of the genome, Francis Crick and Watson. Crick says, the origin of life seems almost to be a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to be, which would have had to have been satisfied to get it going. So Crick himself, very much a secular person, says the word miracle. Okay, and then Leslie Orgel, he's another famous dude in all of this. There are several tenable theories about the origin of organic material on the primitive Earth, but in no case is the supporting evidence compelling. Similarly, several alternative scenarios might account for the self-organization of a self-replicating entity from prebiotic organic material, but all of those that are well-formulated are based on hypothetical chemical synthesis that are problematic. So in all the research that's being done and all the research that has occurred since, say, 94, you still have leading scientists and experts that are not Christian saying stuff like, it's flawed, whoever believes it's a fool, and it's inconclusive. Okay, so we're seeing that this is becoming highly unattractive as we go through this. Now, regarding this, the information and self-organization, DNA is a communication system that can't be reduced to just physics and chemistry. Now, if you recall, we're going to take a break here in a moment, but if you recall in our naturalism section when we first started the class, and we went through this whole idea of what is naturalism and the problems of naturalism, we talked about this idea of reductionism. Does anybody remember that? Reductionism? Now, a lot of times secular scientists try to reduce behavior in persons, behavior in, say, lions attacking zebras, that sort of behavior. It's reducible to physics and chemistry. In other words, in the naturalistic worldview, the entire universe is just a bunch of things that could be explained with science, with physics and chemistry. There's nothing else out there except that which could be known through the five senses, or could be experimented on or experienced. What was I saying? I forgot. I lost my train of thought. Reductionism, thank you. The idea is that if I could reduce in my conversation with you or in my experiment, if I could prove that everything is the result of chemistry and physics, then I've done away with any need for supernatural, spiritual, anything immaterial at all, the mind, and even the brain chemistry and the brain functions I have. And what I'm saying to you right now is all reducible to a bunch of things firing in my head because other things cause them to fire in my head, and now they're producing a bunch of noise. But again, it's not because I'm thinking thoughts that are driving my mouth to speak. It's just because there's a bunch of C fibers firing and neurons moving a bunch of creating electrochemical signals in my brain, and that's why I'm speaking this stuff. But there's actually no meaning to the words I'm saying, right? This is the idea of reductionism. It all could be reduced to physics and chemistry. And so this is kind of a problem with this idea of reducing information to physics and chemistry. And what we will see here when we come back from the break is why that's a problem. Why, if someone tries to reduce information to physics and chemistry, they automatically hit this issue that basically causes this to be extremely unattractive. And we'll talk about that in about 5 minutes, okay? So why don't we take a quick break? Thank you so much. You get a free pass to pass the class. Okay, regarding the information and self-organization in general, okay, what other criticisms do we have? DNA is a communication system that can't be reduced to physics and chemistry. So we talked again about what is reductionism and how things oftentimes in science, due to a naturalistic worldview and other reasons, are reduced too far. So the idea is that DNA, researchers try to reduce to just physics and chemistry. And the reason why that doesn't work is that if you consider the analogy of newspapers, they communicate with ink, which is physics and chemistry, okay? There's something pushing on a pen and ink, say the chemistry, is coming out. But the ink cannot determine the order of the words. Physics and chemistry cannot sequence words on the paper. So if I used just natural processes, say no person was pushing on the pen, let's just say there's ink floating around in the air and ink is a bunch of chemicals, that cannot produce the order of words on a piece of paper. What produces the order of words? Writers, intelligent design. Jesus, okay. Yeah, okay, so physics and chemistry cannot sequence words on the paper. In the same way, physics and chemistry cannot determine the sequences of amino acids. Now, the reason why is because information in DNA is a transcending order distinct from physics and chemistry. If you remember 2 weeks ago when I said a bunch of confusing stuff about how order is this, it's like an abstract thing and it kind of imposes itself on stuff. Order is pre-existing. It's something that is not in the thing itself. Well, we could even grant that order is, say, in the thing itself. Let's just say for the sake of argument, even though those other leading scientists say this is a bunch of bad stuff, that let's just say that order is here. But the thing is, DNA is not just order. DNA is information. It's different. So information in DNA is order. It's a transcending order, but it's more than that. DNA nucleotides could have bonding affinities as some amino acids do, like we talked about. There are some amino acids that do have little bonding affinities, and they produce things that are really out of order, like that. And DNA nucleotides couldn't have these bonding affinities as some amino acids do, as they would create repeated patterns. Okay, so suppose something has a bonding affinity. And let's just do it over here, for instance. And I have a bonding affinity between A, G, C, T, which are the first letters of the names of the nucleotides in the DNA strand. And let's just say A, G, C, T was something like in English, I don't know the word, like. And let's say if I just had produced, if I'm making a strand of something, and this strand spells out this word, which means nothing. It's meaningless. It doesn't, if this was considered in cell terms, it would produce a non-functioning cell. It's just a bunch of amino acids in some strange order. They don't do anything. And so now let's suppose that these are the bonding affinities of the nucleotides in the DNA strand. And let's suppose that they create this word and they do it over and over again because that's the bonding affinity. That's what it does. It aligns I to the K to the E, and then so forth, L to the I, and then it starts again, another I. And then you keep getting this word over and over again. That's what would happen if you had bonding affinities in the DNA strand itself, in the nucleotides. You would have a repeated word. And repeated words, if I stood up here tonight and I just said the word like 100,000 times, would you come back to the class? No. Because why? I'm not giving you information. What is information? It's the arranging of letters to form words, words to form sentences, sentences to form propositions, thoughts. And so the idea here is that if you have the nucleotides and they had bonding affinities, you would get something like this repeating itself, and you would get a non-functioning cell. Make sense? So, this would determine the output of amino acids as repeated sequence, which would not give enough variety for the different proteins required for the, take out the word vast range of, just delete vast range of, and just leave the word cell at the end. So the idea is that if you had this repeated sequence, you would not get enough variety for the different proteins required for the cell. So let's say I have this repeated sequence. It's only going to, say it gives me one type of protein. Let's just say, for instance, I have 150 of these things in a row, and then the 150 keep repeating itself, because you need 150 to form any functional protein. And that 150 kept repeating itself. Well, you're going to get that one type of protein over and over and over again. It's just going to keep producing that one type, right? Because that's what that word is telling the RNA to read and go make. But we don't have that in the cell. We have a variety of sequences on the DNA nucleotide strand. We have a bunch of letters arranged in a certain order that produce different proteins, because there's different words. And so that's what you need. You need a bunch of different proteins to form a cell, because the cell has tons of different types of proteins. So this would effectively cause total loss of information, as the sequencing would be stuck in a repeat pattern, like a record repeating a sound. You know the old records? They start repeating themselves. CDs do that too. That's what you would get if you had bonding affinities between nucleotides of the DNA molecule. Okay? DNA sequences in F must be physically indeterminate. Indeterminate meaning non-determinate, meaning that there's no predestined arrangement of the DNA as nucleotides. When I say nucleotides, does everybody know what I'm talking about? I bet Randall knows, but does anybody else know? I keep using. Yes, that's right. Okay, two people know. Does anybody else know what a nucleotide is? I keep saying that, and everyone's blank stares, and I'm talking about it all night. No one cares to tell me.
It's connected to the moon.
So do you remember that kind of weird double helix thing I tried to draw last time? And there was these little stars on it. Do you remember that? Did any of you draw that in your notes? Like good students? Like Christians would? If you love Jesus, you would have drawn this. If you don't have that in your notes right now, you need to come to the altar in the church next door. So remember these little stars? These are the nucleotides. Do you remember that? I'm getting excited here. I'm in art class. This is an art class, by the way. So these are the nucleotides. And nucleotides. Okay? So, what arranges these things? What is that? What's the origin of the information? Information meaning the sequence of the code, or the sequencing of the nucleotides which form the genetic code. Even if you have, remember we talked about the protein formation, it doesn't matter because what we're really concerned about is this, the DNA. That's the big deal. So let's give them this whole thing about self-organizing proteins. Fine, you can have it, even though we're saying it's prebiotic soup, doesn't make sense, there's no evidence for it, all that stuff. Then we're here, nucleotides, what arranges these things? And they have like a letter, right? This whole A, G, C, T thing. A, G, they're not in this order, but I'm just giving you an example. The A, G, C, T, that's kind of like this stuff, A, G, C, T, the words. And this gives the proteins their gives the amino acids their sequence. The RNA comes and unravels this thing, it reads it, it transcribes it, and it builds that protein. Do you remember we talked about that? A little refreshing? Yeah. Right. Okay, so now everybody caught up? Nucleotides? Okay. Now, again, if these things are predetermined in set places, then you're going to get this repeating pattern, AGCT, AGCT, or the word like, and you're going to keep getting the same protein. That's what I mean by a physically determined repeating pattern, because they have bonding affinities, meaning that there's these little bonds. This is kind of the theory, that there's these little bonds that cause them to come from out here in some funky place, and they get positioned there because it's like a magnetic attraction. They just kind of get sucked into that site on the sugar phosphate backbone. Okay, that would be the idea of the bonding affinities of the nucleotides. And what we're saying that is that can't happen, because if it did, you would only get a repeated pattern which would make only one protein. And it may not even be functional. But the problem is the DNA, when we look at it, it has a ton of different proteins. Different proteins. You have to have a ton of different proteins or you don't have a cell. So that idea in and of itself, just the idea of it, won't work. So, G, the information is exemplified and conveyed by a precise sequencing of matter, nucleotides. So when we talk about information, we talk about these things forming words, if you will, kind of like an article in a newspaper. They get put there by some order that's beyond themselves, that's not inherent in the chemicals themselves. The order comes from outside. This implies that it cannot originate in matter. The order, the sequencing of these nucleotides cannot originate in matter. Information is outside the matter, and that's on the top of page 30. Now, let me go a little deeper with you. We just described the whole concept of this being problematic as a theory, because it would produce one type of protein, but we need lots of different types of protein. The other problem is, when we actually go look in the cell and we do a scientific observation, what do we find? Do we find these little orange, do we find those little orange bonding? Do we find any bonding affinities, or do we find any bonding there? What does that bonding look like? In actuality, there are no bonds. There are no little orange bonds. None. Not that there are some, and that they're kind of like these. There are some, they vary, but they don't make sense when you look at the DNA. There are no bonds between nucleotides along the longitudinal axis of the DNA. None. So the theory breaks down because it doesn't make sense when you think about it. And then when we go look, they're not there. So physical necessity has a lot of problems that we already talked about, but now it has an extreme problem. The problem is there are no bonding affinities. So what does that imply? The order of the nucleotides is imposed from outside. Something else causes the sequencing of the nucleotides that's not the inherent properties of the nucleotide. It's not in the nucleotide itself. Something gives that sequencing. Now, think of it, if you remember, say this is a magnetic whiteboard, and if I had these magnetic little pieces, you know those letters that you can put on your fridge, and you can kind of form words with them, and you can arrange them in any different way? Well, the bond of the letter to the whiteboard, the magnetic whiteboard, is the same for each letter, right? So if I have an A, it has that same magnet behind it, it's the same strength, a bond to the whiteboard. If I have a C, it's the same thing. A Q, it's the same thing. The bond to the whiteboard is the same for every letter. And I can order them. I can position all these letters all over the place on this whiteboard, and it's just a meaningless bunch of letters. But, or I could form them to kind of look like this, like you see words here, and then you'd be able to derive meaning from that. Well, the idea is same is true for DNA. The bonds here on the sugar phosphate backbone are the same. So if I was to show bonds from here to here, like this, we do find bonds there when we go look at it and have a scientific observation. We do find. So some have proposed that these are the bonds that order the nucleotides, which are hanging out in some, I don't know, prebiotic soup out here. Say the A, G, C. These are the nucleotides. These are the bonds that cause them to be attracted to the sugar phosphate backbone and give the order. Those little red bonds. But the problem with that idea is that each bond has the same strength. They have the same attraction, if you will, each little red bond. And so that means is any AGCT could go in any one of those sites. In other words, this red, the theorist is proposing that this red is a big one, so that only attracts A's. That is a little one, so that only attracts T's. That's a super big one, so that attracts G's. There's nothing like that. They're all the same bonds. They're all the same strength. So what that means is any letter could go in any place. It's the same strength. So the point is that both in this direction, longitudinally, there are no bonds, and in this direction, all the bonds are the same strength. So there's nothing about the DNA molecule itself that orders the nucleotides. There's nothing here, naturally speaking, that gives order to the nucleotides along the DNA molecule. And this is something that I'm discussing here on page 30. And we don't have to read it because I just kind of went over it. So again, there's no predetermined order. No nucleotide is favored on the DNA sugar phosphate backbone. They're all equally, they all have equal rights under the law, if you will. They're all, there's no like affirmative action here going on or anything. It's just everybody has a shot, okay? Equal shot. Woman, gay and lesbian, whatever. You get a shot to go on the sugar phosphate backbone, the same shot as everybody else. And it doesn't matter about your qualities, how you look, how you dress. If you're AGCT, it doesn't matter. It kind of is like LBCT, you know? If you're AGCT, you can go anywhere you want on the sugar phosphate backbone. And the point is that there's no self-organizing happening here. And that's the big deal. So they can do a ton of experiments till they're blue in the face forever and ever and ever to how to generate a protein by self-organizational experiments. But this can't ever, never have any experiment done to show how these things are ordered, because we already know enough about them. There's no bonds this way, and there's the same bond that way. That's all there is to know. So the point is, this is ordered from outside. Something else orders them. Now, if you go to page 31, you can skip that because I just talked about it. With these two features of the double helix DNA molecule, there is absolutely zero evidence that the nucleotides self-organize to the double helix due to physical causes. There is not a physical force of attraction or any other necessary bonding to explain the specific information of the genetic code. The certain combination required for a functional protein will not necessarily obtain just because there is a prebiotic soup on the Earth's surface. As such, an alleged inevitable attraction completely lacks evidence. The properties of the biological building blocks, nucleotides, and the sugar phosphate DNA backbone do not determine their own arrangement. Okay, so an example you could think of is bricks do not just build a castle based on their own material properties. Okay, I work as a structural engineer full-time. I've been doing it for 10 years. I'm licensed in the state of California, and I'm taking an advanced license exam in April. I can guarantee you that bricks don't just start building themselves a building. They sit in a site, they get compressed, all this dust, concrete, cement, it's a whole process, and they form a brick. The brick doesn't go anywhere. Who determines the orders of the bricks? The architect, the engineer, the designer. I do. I'm the engineer. I determine where the bricks go. They're not even called bricks, they're called concrete masonry units. But the point is, you don't get a church out of a bunch of blocks at a warehouse. You don't get a five-story building with a bunch of steel at a fabrication shop. What determines the arrangement? It's the engineer. It's the designer. Likewise, building blocks do not just self-assemble. Building blocks being nucleotides. Now, this building blocks word, just to give you a heads up, if you go scour the internet, you're going to hear the word building blocks all over the place. So you have to ask, what type of building block are you talking about? Are you talking about the amino acids, or are you talking about the nucleotides? So there's a little confusion there. So be careful of that. Be careful of that. You can give them this. You have a conversation, whatever, on the street. You can give them that, even though there's no evidence for, or bad evidence for this, not good evidence for that, bad evidence for protein, all that stuff by self-attraction properties. You can give them all that. But the point is that when you talk about building blocks for the DNA, that's the issue. Yes?
So is it that's common?
Everybody agrees on that. There's no argument there. It's just you go look at the DNA. That's what you see. Jay, a vast ensemble of possible combinations are available with the biological building blocks, meaning nucleotides in that sense. A vast ensemble of arrangements. Any order is possible. Any order is possible on this sequence because there's no predetermined order. Okay, specification is needed to place them together in a way that creates function. It can't just be a bunch of letters. It has to be letters that produce proteins that are functional. Based on these two features, we see that this specification is not self-organized or predetermined based on the inherent internal properties of DNA. So again, when we're talking about DNA sequencing, that cannot be self-organizing for the reasons we just discussed. Yes, sir? Yeah.
Is that always the way completed DNA works? Is that the same information on both lines?
No. The information is an A here is not necessarily corresponding to an A there. There may be a G there. same C, and that may be a T or something like that. There are these little hydrogen bonds right here, but those get broken every time this thing is read. When the thing unwinds, the RNA reads it, these hydrogen bonds get broken. But again, these hydrogen bonds are also not something that, they're very weak. They don't cause order. Sides? Yeah, they call them like triplets, or they call them base pairs. Like this and that would be a base pair. The triplet, I think, may be the one right above it. But, I mean, these are just nomenclature to describe it. I'm not sure if there's a pattern from one side to the other. I don't know. Now, Bernd Ulof Cupers, who is mentioned as a leading researcher in Eugenie Scott's article that we talked about before from 1994, she mentions these big shots. He says, okay, this is, again, a leading researcher referenced by Eugenie Scott, the National Center for Science Education, and she hates ID theorists pretty much. He says, the properties of nucleic acids indicate that all the combinatorial possible nucleotide patterns of a DNA are, from a chemical point of view, equivalent. What he means is that you can get any order because they're all equivalent. Any nucleotide can go on any place. Transferring the problem of the origin of the information does not solve the problem. Okay, so this happens a lot with research, is they transfer the problem, but it doesn't solve the problem of what ordered those sequences. Information cannot be reduced, and any attempts to do so will necessarily fail, as it must presuppose the nature of specified information. So anytime you try to even explain this away, you still are presupposing the truth of the idea of sequenced nucleotides and the information that brings. Now, Meyer says this, new laws will never explain the origin of information because the processes that laws describe necessarily lack the complexity that informative sequences require. Okay, so there's major issues when you try to reduce, when you're being a reductionist and you try to reduce this. Now, Christian de Duve, he's a leading scientist and also a naturalist. He says, cells are so obviously programmed to develop according to certain lines that the word design almost unavoidably comes to mind. Then he goes on to say that it can't be designed based on his naturalism, and apparently de Duve agrees with Meyer on the fact that the origin of information is yet to be explained, as he mentioned this to him in a conversation after one of their talks. So just a little side conversation. He kind of agreed with Meyer on a whole bunch of stuff. And at a conference, I guess this was one of their talks on the side after it was all over. The information is extrinsic, meaning outside, to the physics and chemistry. It's beyond the physics and chemistry. The chemistry and the physics don't give the information. It is independent of it, and it comes from outside the physics and chemistry. Physics and chemistry do not determine the messaging. And again, if it were physics and chemistry, we would just get repeating messaging in the sequence, which we talked about, and we would get a molecular repetitive message, ABC, ABC, ABC. And information theorists call this just redundancy. And there would be no variation as well. So that's what we need, again, for the cell, is there would be no, that we have variation, that there's indeterminacy happening here. Now, so what that means is that it kind of goes against this whole idea of physical necessity. So what are we left with? Now, in and of itself, based on the process of elimination, we can see that this is the only one standing that is considered to be valid in terms of the scientific community, or what is recognized as an option. Most people just refute this as saying it's not optional because of naturalism. But these are the three main ones, the predominant ones, if you will. So does this have any merit on its own? I mean, it's just like, oh, crap, design, dang it. You know, is it like that? Or does this one look good on its own merits? So where did the information come from? Can the design hypothesis be formulated into a rigorous scientific argument? I guess that's another story. But the idea here that all we're trying to do is make an inference to the best explanation. Which one of these theories best explains the evidence? One, two, or three? So again, you posit causes which could explain it, then infer the one that best explains it the best. What does it mean to be the best explanation? It would be a cause of some kind. And again, if you think back a few classes ago, we had a bunch of criteria that we could apply to a set of hypotheses and say, does it have enough explanatory power? Does it have enough explanatory scope? Is it ad hoc in any way? Does it outrival the competing hypothesis by a long shot? These sorts of questions, that sort of criteria. But the other inferences, chance and necessity, and the combination of chance and necessity fail to explain the origin of information. Now, Henry Quassler, he's an information scientist, he said the creation of new information is habitually associated with conscious activity. So whenever we find information and the creation of it, we always find a mind doing it. And so, interestingly, the same is true for this. So we're not reasoning from analogy, we're reasoning by inference to the best explanation. When we have information, what causes that? We know of no other cause of information in the world other than minds producing information. And that's a big point, is that, and this gets overlooked, is that every time we see information on this planet, we always see it coming from intelligence. And so the same is true here. Now, I'm going to remind the class that I'm getting a lot of this material from a lot of those resources in the back. And some of this stuff, I'm not repeating word for word, but I'm kind of summarizing stuff in those books. So I just want to make that very clear, that if you find this to be a good argument, you can thank those guys. But some of this stuff, I just want to make sure you know that if you go listen to something on YouTube, you're like, hey, Jeremy stole that stuff. I'm like, yeah, I totally did. I'm telling you right now, I stole it. But what I'm trying to do is give it to you because a lot of you won't go read those books. So this is the way that I'm doing all the research for you, and I'm giving it to you for free. And so thank me in heaven. But that's what all teachers do, just to let you know. If you go to college, if you've been to college, you're going to get a bunch of stuff that most of them didn't come up with when they give it to you. They either go off the textbook directly, or they research the scholars or they studied under these certain people when they were getting their PhD, and they go and do the same thing I'm doing. So, I'm just trying to be a college professor. That's all. Question? Okay. now turn the page. So again, let's just skip a couple things. When information is traced back to its source, we always come to a mind and not natural forces. This idea uses the uniformitarianism of Darwin and Charles Lyell. Charles Lyell was a geologist before Darwin, and they use this idea of uniformitarianism, is this idea of, it's a method of multiple competing hypotheses, it's a method of inference to the best explanation. Now, uniformitarianism is simply this. We know of things that are true in the present day because they occur in front of us, and we see them occurring and unfolding in front of us. And then we can say that since we see these things in the present day that they have this process, we can infer that they always were that way. They did that same thing back then too. In other words, there's a uniform continuing of nature to behave in the same way. The behavior of nature is uniform. So if you put a word on that, call it uniformitarianism, it's the same thing what we're doing here. We know of no other way information is derived or created on this planet other than a mind creating it. And if that's true of us, it's also true of that. So uniformitarianism as a principle, just like Darwin used that idea, and just like Lyell did when he studied the rock formations and he developed this idea of the age of the Earth being 3-4 billion years old, we're doing the same thing here. We're using uniformitarianism, and we're saying just as we create new information now, that's how this new information was created too. It was created through a mind. Now, if you go down to 10, another analogy can be derived from computers. I'm going to skip this part, but the idea is that some people make the comparison between DNA and a computer. And I think I mentioned last class that DNA has the storage capacity of like an Encyclopedia Britannica for like one DNA, right? one cell's worth of DNA, and we have like, who knows how many bazillion cells in our body, right? So we have in our body the a library, I believe. If you think of just how many books are in a library in terms of the capacity of information, that's how much information can be stored in the cell in every human. I don't know if it's like a college library or if it's like your city public library, but say some decent-sized library. That's how much information can be stored in the human, one human being's bunch of cells. A lot of information. Now, I mentioned before that also they are writing, they wrote a book into a DNA strand. Do you remember me saying that? These guys at Harvard and Johns Hopkins University, they composed, if you will, kind of like writing to a CD, information to DNA, and they took a whole book and wrote it into this biotechnology, if you will. And so there have been many comparisons of DNA to the computer and the cell to the computer, because the cell has mechanisms that cause physical things to move around. And so I want to just kind of give you that picture that just as you like hit something on your computer to open the CD and it ejects the CD tray, the same is true for like this information. This information causes physical things to happen, like opening of the CD tray, if you will. So in many ways, DNA and the cell were like a primitive computer whenever they first came to the planet, whenever God or some alien brought them here. Now, I think that is really fascinating, and I would invite you to look up stuff on how the cell compares to the computer, or how the DNA strand compares to the computer. Kind of research that for yourself, because I think you'll find that extremely fascinating. Isn't it interesting that 2,000 years after Christ and, say, 10,000 years, say, after Adam and Eve, let's just say, if you're a Christian in here and you think Adam and Eve are real people, let's say 10,000 years after Adam and Eve, let's say they lived 10,000 years ago, we're developing computers, like with all of our amazing technology. But way back when, God had the first computer in his mind. He developed it himself with the cell. And I invite you to look into that comparison on your own. Now, that's basically all I have for you here. I just kind of summarized what I was writing here. And then note why at the very bottom of page 36, that responses to Stephen Meyer's book, Signature in the Cell, and counter responses by Meyer's team can be found at this footnote. So if you type that in, you'll get this PDF or some sort of document that will have people writing about Meyer's book, which is where I've got a lot of my stuff from, and other sources too, like this and other sources, not just Meyer, but Meyer had some like major breakthroughs in the ID movement in bringing to light all the things we talked about. So he's kind of a big figure in this sense. And so if you're a critic, you want to attack Meyer. And so you could find these criticisms of Meyer's work and his responses to those criticisms, or his team's responses, at that website. And again, I don't have time to go through all the back and forth responses, but I think you'll find, based on me going over that document, the responses are very bad. And many times, Casey, I think one of his research assistants, says that the person who's responding or criticizing Meyer didn't even read his book. It was like they looked at the table of contents and stuff. So there's some really bad, bad criticisms of Meyer. Now, so what we're finding is that design looks very attractive, and it looks to us like it's the best information, best hypothesis. And so that's the one I hold. And now the question is, how did design get to the cell? I mean, did God just kind of zap it from heaven or something like that? Well, you know, we don't even have to go there, because the whole idea is that if we build a case that intelligent design is found in nature, if one can detect design using the explanatory filter, which we talked about here on all those probabilities, if you remember from two classes ago, if one could just detect design, then it fits really nicely in this four-premise argument that I built. So again, we're on premise three. If this premise is true, if there is design, we don't care how it got there, we don't care who put it there, we don't care when it came on the earth at all. And we don't care if it just supplements natural causes. You know, if natural causes cause a lot of stuff, say evolution, you know, and intelligent design is part of that, and natural causes relies on design in some sense, we still have design, don't we? And so in that sense, premise three would be true when examining biochemistry, which is all this stuff. And so if premise three is true in terms of biochemistry, then our argument so far has been unrefuted, and it stands, premise one, two, and three. And premise four we'll find is true as well. And so again, we're building a strong inductive case that has a lot of explanatory power for Christianity being supported by science. Questions on this or anything so far?
On the RNA, is each RNA different? Like when it comes to concepts, does each one have a particular like key address that it starts on that it picks up on, or is it individually instructed to go to this address?
Oh man, that's a great question. We talked about there being a need for 150 nucleotides in order. So out of all of the nucleotides, say the millions on one DNA strand in one cell, where does that RNA go? How does it know where to go? I think it goes to a bunch of different places. And what is so fascinating is that there's something called splicing that happens. So the RNA will go and unravel this thing, or this thing is actually unraveled by a protein, a functional protein, unravels it so it kind of is like this now, temporarily, and all these nucleotides are kind of exposed, and they're, you know, on both sides. And then the RNA thing comes and reads them, right? Where does it go is your question. Well, what's fascinating is it kind of picks some from there, say, I don't know, 300, then it picks another 300 right there, and it splices them together to form advanced information or additional information. So the information is there in some order, and then it goes and picks words, if you will, and kind of forms, puts them together almost like as if it's forming sentences. It's quite fascinating. The other interesting thing is the cell, the same cell that we have is the same cell in a bunch of other animals and other more primitive life forms. So this splicing doesn't necessarily happen the more primitive life form you get. And I'll leave it there. I could say a few more things, but splicing, and then there's also like the spell check feature, if you will, of DNA, where or the cell. The cell actually, sometimes when the DNA is copied, I think when the cell replicates, there is a copy error. So let's say like pixelation from YouTube to your computer, like some YouTube server has this video, comes to your computer, and maybe there's a error in the copying of the zeros and the ones, the computer language. Well, you can get maybe an error, I don't know, one per 50 trillion bytes of information, who knows what it is. There's like an error rate in the copying process. It's like one per billion nucleotides or something. Well, the cell actually spell checks, if you will, when it copies, and it corrects that stuff. So it corrects the nucleotides in the sequence. So there's things like that. There's one other really cool feature. I can't remember what it was, but there's so many. So the DNA is actually quite fascinating. Other questions? Okay. We can talk more if you like up here. If not, I'll leave the irreducible complexity thing for maybe something I'll just cover next week as we start. Otherwise, we'll get into the criticisms of evolution, macroevolution, and other parts of evolutionary theory. Okay? So why don't we pray? Dear Lord Jesus, thank you so much for this and information in our bodies and in the cells. And we hope, God, that this could be useful in understanding you more. And we pray that you'd help us to learn more about this and sharpen our minds so that our hearts would be more open to you. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, thank you.